Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. That's the national anthem of the Republic of South Sudan, which became a country on July 9th, 2011. Even then, as tens of thousands celebrated the birth of their new nation, many also feared that political and ethnic divisions would persist and eventually unravel this burgeoning democratic republic. 3 weeks ago, violence broke out and already has cost at least 1,000 lives. Coming up, we'll hear from Bol Awang. He is one of the former Lost Boys of Sudan, now a U.S. citizen in Columbus, who has worked with others to open a health clinic in his former village. Joining us now by phone from Nairobi, Kenya, is Nicholas Kulish, East Africa correspondent for The New York Times. Welcome to the show, Nicholas.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Is this a civil war, a rebel uprising, a government action? What do you call the violence that has gripped South Sudan since mid-December?
Well, we've been avoiding the term civil war, but I don't think it would be entirely inaccurate when you describe two sides within a country that have fought in five, maybe now six of the country's 10 states, more than 20 cities across the country, killing the thousand figure is quite old, probably thousands of people at this stage. So I don't think it would be entirely inaccurate, but I think people are also holding out hope that they can put a lid on this and bottle it up before it goes too far.
The president didn't just fire his vice president, but his entire cabinet last summer. That leaves the country unstable in any event, and the two sides remain divided over the release of politicians arrested at the time after President Salva Kiir accused them of joining in a coup by his former vice president. What about the coup? That's another uncertainty, something that seems to continue to be unclear.
The coup is the alleged coup, as we call it, is a major sticking point. The government insists that there was a coup. The rebels insist that there wasn't. Many people believe that it started as a skirmishing within different factions of the presidential guard, and then was assumed to be a coup. But you know, this isn't simply semantics, because the government is insisting that that the rebel side admit that they were launching a coup before they're willing to talk peace. And the rebel side is basically saying, no, we've been arrested for unjustified reasons, and you know that would undermine our entire legitimacy. So this, as much as it sounds like sort of a question of definition, that's one of the major sticking points in getting peace back to South Sudan.
Now, leaders from both sides are meeting now, right?
Yes, not the president or the former vice president, but there are delegations in a luxury hotel in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. But so far, it appears that very, very little progress has been made there. There have been next to no face-to-face meetings where anything has actually been discussed, and the two sides appear to have very hardened positions on what their expectations are for moving forward.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Nicholas Kulish, East Africa correspondent for The New York Times, about the violence and conflict in South Sudan. If you have a question, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. Nicholas, you wrote this week that nowhere are foreign leaders watching this crisis with more interest and more at stake than Sudan to the north. What are the leaders there doing about the troubles in South Sudan?
Well, I think that Sudan, as formerly part of the same country as South Sudan, as a place that has financially suffered a great deal since South Sudan broke away and took the oil fields with it, has really almost everything at stake. A lot of people didn't maybe get through in the United States, but there were significant riots, not unlike the Arab Spring, that led to deaths in the streets and hundreds, if not thousands, of arrests in Khartoum earlier this year. So for them, it's really critical that the money that they still get from the oil pipelines and from the oil processing continues to flow into their coffers. So far, they have taken a fairly constructive role. In the past, South Sudan has accused the Khartoum government of providing weapons and funding to rebel groups. So the that's a real concern out there. But they believe that they have a fairly strong agreement in place right now with the South Sudanese government in Juba, and so they've been supportive of the government position thus far.
The U.S., China, and other countries are concerned and pressing for a resolution. How important is this to the U.S., and is it just about the oil?
I think it's actually more about the oil for the Chinese, who are the recipients of the overwhelming share of the South Sudanese oil and who have paid for or serviced a lot of the oil infrastructure there in South Sudan. For the United States, I think it has a lot more to do with the fact that George W. Bush's government and Barack Obama's governments both put a lot of pressure for independence and for this country to have a chance. They kind of went out on the limb, you could say, for the idea of South Sudan. To have that now turning into more violence, into more years of fighting and killing of civilians would be, I think, seen as both a humanitarian disaster, which it is, I've seen it with my own eyes, and also a real disappointment and a failure for the U.S. government.
They've invested a lot of resources, including money, into the country of South Sudan, but a lot of critics say they didn't invest a lot of time in helping South Sudan prepare to be a country.
Yeah, I think, and some people are saying maybe there should have been more of a transition period, maybe there should have been a period of tutelage where the United Nations or the United States or someone helped, rather than simply taking a place that had been racked by war for decades and kind of like a child learning to ride a bicycle, just sort of took off the training wheels and gave them a push. On the other hand, you know, I think that, as you said, a lot of money has been put into the country, a lot of support. You run into NGOs and advisors and all kinds of people when you're in Juba under normal circumstances. I think in some ways we wish that things like this wouldn't happen, and so we blame ourselves, but South Sudan is not a country that has been ignored or left without support.
Is there a sense that the violence there can be contained, or could it have a domino effect throughout that region?
I think that, you know, you see Central African Republic is already in worse shape with internal fighting than South Sudan. Uganda has troops in South Sudan, which they say are to help their own and protect their own citizens, and yet there's quite a few of them. They have some air power there. I think the scenario that people fear the most is that different countries will pick sides and support them. If Uganda too aggressively backed the government, would their rivals in Khartoum change their mind and decide to side with the rebels? I think what everybody would like to see is most of all the South Sudanese people, who I think we have to keep in the forefront of this, would like to see is a de-escalation and a return to peace.
Several journalists from the region have cautioned against calling this just another tribal or ethnic conflict, but there is a violent history. Is it Kiir, the president, Kiir or Kiir, his ethnic group?
Kiir.
The Dinka and Mr. Marshall, leader of the Nuer ethnic group. Mr. Marshall, of course, is vice president who was fired last summer. It's being seen in terms of violence between those two ethnic groups, too.
This is a major sticking point, or you could sort of call it a Twitter controversy if you wanted. You know, I think it's actually pretty clear cut, which is this started out very much as a political dispute between powerful politicians in the capital of Juba. The people who supported Vice President Machar, or I should say former Vice President Machar, when he was presenting proposals for changing the leadership structures within the party, were from many different ethnic groups. There were Dinka, there were Nuer, there were Shilluk, there were other people. But unfortunately, it was quickly instrumentalized, and killing did take on an ethnic character. And so to ignore the fact that I have talked to dozens of Nuer who are afraid to leave UN bases in Juba because they believe they'll be killed, to ignore the fact that I've talked to dozens of Dinka in places like Owerrial County across from Bor who are certain they would be killed if they returned to Bor, is to ignore some of the problems here in this situation.
South Sudan has been a country for almost exactly 2.5 years. Has it ever enjoyed a level of what Westerners might think of as real peace?
I mean, unfortunately, the answer is probably not. I was there this summer when there was fighting between the Nuer and the Merle, and there have been skirmishes and rebellions in different parts of the country at different times. Obviously, that never... You know, you'll have huge swaths of the population that are living in peace and are just trying to improve their lives and get by. But this wasn't the first example of instability or the first example of violence since the independence referendum.
One of my guests coming up is one of the former Lost Boys of Sudan, Bol Awang, who has since become an American citizen, but who remains connected to his homeland, has visited there and has helped found a health clinic in his home village in South Sudan. You've spoken with and written about others like Bol who have returned to live in South Sudan or at least visit there and try to help their people. How are they taking this turn of events?
Well, I mean, I think it's very difficult to go through what these men went through as children, and to then make such an effort, as so many of them have, to give something back to the country, to return. Building health clinics is something I've come across in a number of instances. Starting think tanks, you name it. I mean, people really, the Lost Boys, I think, have shown themselves to give more back probably than most people do. And it's obviously very sad then to see this kind of fighting and this kind of violence. And I mean, I think obviously you can ask the next guest for his opinion, but I think that these are also people who are unusually resilient and have been through a lot and therefore are, you know, ready to take the next challenge and see how they can make things better no matter what the situation.
And what about the humanitarian challenge there with people leaving crossing the Nile has been very dangerous. Lots of lives have been lost just doing that, trying to get away from the violence.
Yeah, I mean, the humanitarian situation there is extremely difficult. And, you know, I've been to a number of different camps or encampments, unofficial, for internally displaced people. And the estimate is now over 200,000 people. And some of them have access to aid and to clean water, but a lot of them don't. And those are just the official people that are being serviced by the humanitarians. But there's also a lot of people will flee the population centers and go into the bush in the hopes of finding safety in isolation. And those people do not then often have the access to the kind of food and water and medicine and other services that they need. And, I mean, the suffering has been really extreme. The humanitarian groups are doing everything they can. I've seen that with my own eyes. But I don't believe that they have yet been able to meet those extreme needs.
Nicholas Kulish, thanks for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Good to be here.
That's Nicholas Kulish. He's talking to us from Kenya. He's East Africa correspondent for The New York Times. Coming up, we'll talk with Bol Awang, our OSU graduate, one of the former Lost Boys of Sudan, and also a scholar from the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. So stay with us. We'll continue our conversation about the conflict in South Sudan when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. 2.5 years ago, Bol Awang, an OSU graduate and one of the former Lost Boys of Sudan, joined us in the studio to mark the birth of the Republic of South Sudan. Even then, we talked about the challenges that the people of South Sudan faced as a new nation. last month, apparently political, ethnic, as yet to be defined violence erupted after months of political unrest, which escalated last summer when President Salva Kiir fired his vice president. At least 1,000, well, we now know that many more than 1,000 people have died since about mid-December, and some 200,000 people are believed to have fled their homes at this time. Bola Wang returns to the studio today to talk about the conflict, what he's seen during his visits as a mission team leader for the Buckeye Health Clinic, which he co-founded in his home village of Peel, South Sudan. Thanks for joining us again today, Bol.
Thank you, Anne.
Also with us is Richard Downey, Deputy Director of the Africa Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. Thanks for joining us, Richard.
Nice to be with you.
In a report you wrote on the state of public health in South Sudan, you said that because the terms of separation from Sudan weren't spelled out before independence, negotiations over a variety of issues have dragged on. Why weren't the terms set in stone beforehand? What do we know about that?
Well, there were a lot of things to be resolved, and in the kind of rush preceding independence, it was just impossible to resolve them. You had two sides, the new nation of South Sudan and Sudan in the north. You had these long list of grievances dating back many, many years and very, very complicated issues, and neither side was particularly willing to budge on them. And one of the most important, well, two of the most important ones were, first of all, working out where the border was between these two nations, and that's yet to be decided and in many places and has caused a lot of tension. The second one is how to manage the oil that is abundant in South Sudan, but can only be exported through a pipeline through the north. So really, the two new countries had to come together and work out how to do this, and it's never really happened. And the international community perhaps didn't put enough pressure on these two sides to reach a deal on some of these tricky issues.
Although, as we were talking with Nicholas Kulish of the New York Times, there's not been a lack of funds and resources given to South Sudan.
No, that's right. And the U.S., has been the main donor of providing development assistance to South Sudan in its early years. A lot of that assistance has gone into providing health services, providing education services, basic primary services like that. Where I think the mistake has been made is that there's not been enough focus on the political side of things, which is necessary to get the country up and running and running successfully. And perhaps the U.S. and other well-wishers of South Sudan haven't put enough pressure on the new government of South Sudan to work on promoting democracy, getting supporting civil society, free media, all those kinds of things that help a new nation become a well-governed nation.
Bola Wang, we last talked in July 2011 on the day that the Republic of South Sudan became a new country, and we had a good time.
That's right.
You were hopeful, but you were also cautious. You've visited South Sudan since then. Looking back, did you feel that it was a rushed event, that they were rushing it and maybe should have put more in order before becoming independent?
I think that that was the right time to do it. And what was so confusing is that most of the politicians in South Sudan, they were the ones that fought the war, and their mentality is all about the war. And to run a country, you need to have a knowledge about the civilian, not about how to fight the war. So that's the only case now. Because most of the people would use the orders that they used during the war to apply it in politics rather than using the dialogue that could have been used to bring everybody together and run the country in the right way.
That's an interesting point. Richard Downey, they put people in charge who had been fighting each other instead of maybe putting bureaucrats in charge and people who could run agencies and actually run a country.
Yeah, and Bowles hit on a critical point there. You know, the people now running the country were guerrilla fighters who were very expert in fighting a long campaign of resistance and successful in birthing their new nation through war. But those skills aren't exactly very relevant when you're running a new country. And these are people who are used to giving orders rather than perhaps listening to others and acting in a representative and an accountable way. So, yes, they're perhaps not the ideal people to be running a country. But the problem is that there weren't many alternatives, frankly. The war went on for so many decades that a whole generation of people lost their ability to go to school, to get trained up, to become experts and bureaucrats and people who have the skills to run a country. And people like Bohr, had to flee for their lives from the country. And so a whole generation of skills was lost there. And that's why South Sudan is in such a tricky position right now as it tries to run a new country with very, very few skills to draw upon.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. You just heard from Richard Downey from the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, where he is deputy director of the Africa program. Also with us, Paula Wang, OSU grad and one of the former Lost Boys of Sudan. He's now a U.S. citizen in Columbus and has worked with others to open a health clinic in his former village. We'll be talking about that later on. Richard Downey, one former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Africa has proposed that South Sudan be placed under United Nations trusteeship. He said that of all the African nations that came to independence since 1950, South Sudan has had the least amount of preparation.
Yeah, it's an interesting and a kind of controversial idea. I mean, many of the African countries that reached independence in the last 50 or so years did so with very little assistance and preparation from outside. That's certainly true with South Sudan as well. But I'm wondering, really, is the UN the right body to be able to run something so complicated as helping an infant country get up on its feet? Because there is a UN mission right now in South Sudan, only 7,000 strong, although it's been authorized to double in size. But it's frankly been unable to stem the violence in South Sudan or get a grip on the events. It's really just been standing on the sidelines. And so I'm not really sure that the UN has either the capacity or the ability to help South Sudan in its hour of need right now.
Bola Wang, how does that feel to you, like a gigantic step backwards, just not doable anyways, as Richard Downey is suggesting? What do you make of proposals like that?
I think that proposal wouldn't work. That's the way I feel it.
It would work?
It wouldn't work.
It would not work, yeah.
Yeah, it would not work. Because recently, during this fighting, United Nations is back there in the country. And with the war that's going on in the city of Bor particularly, the what so-called white army from Nuer was coming to the town of Bor. And United Nations was there watching the white army coming there. And they are coming there to do the harm. But United Nations could not stop them. They could not do anything to prevent that genocide that has been caused by the white army in the area of Bor. So I don't think United Nations could be helpful in that way. They could be helpful in humanitarian crisis, like providing the food
right,
and the other thing. But as Richard said, United Nations would not do enough to bridge the gap between the people of South Sudan and the outside world.
Richard Downey, I want to talk with Bola Wang about the health clinic in his former village that he helped found. But there have been, that's where a lot of the money, I think you said, has been going, is to health and those kinds of needs in the country. How, just countrywide, do we know how much of an impact this violence has had on those places, on those efforts?
Well, one of the problems in monitoring the current developments in South Sudan is that we have a very patchy knowledge of what's going on in a lot of the country. Remember, this is a country roughly the size of Texas, very, very rudimentary infrastructure means it's quite difficult to know often what's going on outside the capital of Juba. But we do know that fighting has affected at least half of South Sudan's 10 states. And obviously, the situation is so dangerous for people delivering aid, humanitarian supplies, health services, that those services are really grinding to a halt in the worst affected areas. And that leaves people really to fend for themselves.
So, Bola Wang, tell us about what you know about what's happening at the Buckeye Clinic in your village in South Sudan, where you came from.
Yeah, the Buckeye Clinic that we built has been operating
for about a year now.
Yeah,
right?
For about a year, and we have
congratulations
changed the life of. Thank you. We have changed the life of many children. More than 500 children have been vaccinated in the clinic, and South Sudan have like one child out of five children could not live to age five. But when we provide that clinic there and we provide vaccination to the children, we reduce that chance. So in my village, one child, all five children could live to age five without expecting one child to die before age five. So that was a good progress that we made. But since the time when this crisis began, everybody fled the village. Mostly children who were expected to be treated in the clinic, and mothers who were expected to deliver in the clinic.
Deliver their babies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They are now exposed to the environment that is not comfortable to them. And after the end of this one, what we will hear later on will be different story. Maybe all the children that we put hope on them may not survive this crisis because they will be exposed to malnutrition, to the cholera, and all the other disease and the other uncomfortable things to the life of a human being.
So you had there are employees that were at the clinic now.
Yeah, we have the employees
midwives.
At the clinics. And because the channel of transportation has been cut.
Okay.
So, and all the agencies that bring the medication and other things have been evacuated from the country. So there's no more supply of the medication and all the other need to the clinic.
Richard Downey, as I mentioned earlier, you've written about the public health of South Sudan. It sounds like they were clinging to the edge of a cliff with clinics like the Buckeye Clinic in Bola Wang's home village. It was so tenuous as it was. It would take nothing really to reverse all of the efforts.
Yeah, that's right. The health situation in South Sudan is pretty tough, and Bol's outlined the situation in his home village, and it's really fortunate that people like Bol have stepped up and been able to provide basic services in some clinics and villages across the country. So people have sort of come together, whether South Sudanese themselves, whether international donors, to provide some of these services. But they are very rudimentary, and they certainly don't cover the whole of the country. South Sudan is a fragile place at the best of times. Even before this violence, there was serious conflicts in parts of the country. There's tough weather conditions part of the year, which means it's difficult to reach isolated villages. Diseases disease outbreaks are common. So really, this is a fragile place, and it only requires another sort of emergency to be layered on top for things to get catastrophic pretty quickly. And unfortunately, that's where we seem to be right now. And we won't really know the full impact of the health impact of this current fighting until we get a ceasefire and get people on the ground who are able to reach the most isolated areas.
You mentioned that a whole generation or more went without education as well. Since South Sudan became a country, what were the efforts to establish an educational system there?
Yeah, they're again in their very early stages. There are schools being set up around the country. School is restarting in many places. But again, given the size of the country and the isolation of many of the small villages, really, you know, effective education services are still few and far between. You really have you have them in the 10 state capitals and some of the main towns, but really it's kind of fairly basic stuff at the moment. And it would really take a generation almost to help to get an effective primary education system even up and running.
We're talking about the conflict in South Sudan. My guests, Richard Downey, Deputy Director of the Africa Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C., and also Bola Wang, OSU grad and one of the former Lost Boys of Sudan. He's now a U.S. citizen living in Columbus, but he's worked with others to open a health clinic in his former village. If you, we have a link to the Buckeye Clinic website on our webpage at WOSU.org/allsides. We also have a link to the clinic's Facebook page. So if you want to check that out, please do to learn more. We'll continue our conversation when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the conflict in South Sudan with Richard Downey, Deputy Director of the Africa Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, and also Bola Wang, OSU grad and one of the former Lost Boys of Sudan. He has worked with others to open a clinic in his former village, and we have a link to the clinic website and Facebook page on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. If you want to check that out, if you have a question or a comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@WOSU.org. Richard Downey, I wanted to talk to you about China. China's involved. China cares. China purchases about 80% of the oil that comes from South Sudan through the pipeline that goes through Sudan. How is China managing this? Do you know much about what China's doing and what its role is? Because it's sort of unusual to hear about China caring about anything but China.
Well, China doesn't often talk about what it's doing behind the scenes, but certainly it is playing a role. As you say, it's heavily invested economically, both in South Sudan and in Sudan. At the same time, it publicly professes this policy of non-interference in international affairs, and so it doesn't like to get involved traditionally in the sort of messy business of diplomacy and so on. But it's sufficiently concerned by the fighting in South Sudan to send its foreign minister to try and engage with both sides, try and get a ceasefire in place, because frankly, it's in China's best interests for stability to be restored in South Sudan, so that the oil keeps flowing and that the Chinese oil workers can get back to work, and that China can keep getting the economic gains from oil imports from South Sudan.
Has the oil stopped flowing?
No, at the moment the oil has continued flowing, but there's serious concern because some of the fighting has been taking place in the main oil producing state. In fact, the state capital has apparently been lost. The government has lost control of the state capital to the rebels. So China is very concerned by fighting, particularly around the oil producing area, which is close to the border with Sudan.
There's been talk about the unprecedented action of putting Sudan and South Sudan troops together to guard the pipeline.
That's right. And there were talks earlier this week between Sudan's president, Omar al-Bashir, who went down to Juba and met with President Kiir. in South Sudan, and the two of them were, until very, very recently, were very much hostile to each other. But suddenly, the tables have turned, and both of them see the mutual interest of trying to bring an end to this fighting. One of the most interesting points to come out of that meeting was this idea of some kind of joint security force between Sudan and South Sudan to police the oil production producing areas. Sudan has subsequently denied that discussion took place, but it's very interesting that such an idea is even being raised, you know, between two countries which are so much at odds with each other until so recently.
Yeah, Bola Wang, how does that make you feel to know that they're even talking, although Sudan has denied that that was put forth, but the idea of Sudan troops in South Sudan?
Yeah, when South Sudan get independent, the Sudan was not happy with that, and they tried to do anything that possible to make South Sudan an uncomfortable country. So like what is going on now, they are happy with it. They would say today that we would bring the troop to guard the oil field, but the best of their interest is that they say that long time ago when South Sudan played out that we don't need South Sudan to go because they can manage to rule themselves. So and right now when South Sudan become in this crisis, they feel like, oh yeah, that's what we told you.
They're validated by that.
Yeah.
Richard Downey, Bola Wang saying, well, they've wanted this all along. Does that make things, well, you said, I guess necessity breeds, you know, strange inventions, but.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think common sense would suggest that Sudan would look south and see all this turmoil happening very close to its border and think, look, hang on a second, perhaps it's in our best interest to try and secure a peaceful outcome there. Surely it's not a good idea for our neighbor to be engulfed in fighting that has a spillover effect for us. It jeopardizes our oil industry. But, you know, common sense has not always prevailed in Khartoum, in Sudan, among the regime of Omar al-Bashir. It's constantly interfered in South Sudan, dating back many, many years. What's interesting is that formerly the guy that's now fighting Salva Kiir in South Sudan, Riek Machar, was once allied with Bashir during the sort of darkest days of the civil war. So there's always this suggestion that the two may have teamed up again. I don't actually see that happening from where I am, at least. I think, hopefully good sense is actually prevailing right now in Khartoum, and then looking at South Sudan and thinking, no, it's important that we bring some peace here and work towards finding a peaceful solution.
You've said that the broad opposition to the president crosses ethnic lines. So do you agree that it's a mistake to put too much emphasis on ethnic divisions, even though some of the killing has been done in that way?
Yeah, I don't think we should lead with the ethnic divisions part of the story, although it's very true that there are serious ethnic tensions in South Sudan. They're never very far below the surface, and they can be manipulated by politicians and so forth. But I do think that first and foremost, this is a political dispute within the ruling elite in South Sudan. First and foremost, we need to find a resolution to that political dispute before the politicians lead the citizens into more bloodshed.
How big is that ruling elite? How many people are we talking about? How many people are there that can do the job?
We're talking a very small group of people, and the vast majority of them are former guerrilla fighters and leaders of the SPLA, the guerrilla army that fought for and achieved the liberation of South Sudan. So we're talking a small group of people that have the ability to bring about a resolution. One of the main sticking points right now is that many of these people are currently in, being held in custody. Mm-hmm. When fighting first broke out in the middle of last month, one of the first things President Kiir did was round up 11 very senior members of the SPLM, the governing party, and threw them all in jail, accusing them of siding with the rebels. And as the peace talks kind of struggle along right now in Ethiopia, one of the big demands by Riek Machar and the so-called rebels is that these people are released, because they need to be part of the political dialogue if we're to find an end to this fighting. And I think that really does need to happen.
Right. And has the president said absolutely not?
So far, he's maintaining his position that no, these people have a case to answer, and judicial proceedings need to follow their own course, and until they do so, that they won't be released. But certainly, he's under very, very heavy pressure from his international partners, including the U.S., to have these people released from custody so that they can play a part in the peace talks right now in Ethiopia.
It's interesting, I guess, that there's not a middle class. There's not another class of people that is there pressuring them from inside the country, because everybody but the elite ruling class is very, very poor and just struggling to survive.
That's right. There's this small elite that's clustered in the capital city in Juba that's been running the affairs of South Sudan for quite a long period of time now, and are pretty much unaccountable, whereas the mass of South Sudanese around the country are mostly very, very poor. They have the very little ability to hold their leaders to account. There have been no, although there were elections in 2010 before South Sudan became independent, we've not had an election since independence. There's currently one scheduled for 2015, but given what's going on right now, it's most likely that timescale, timetable will lapse. So, and really, there aren't many, there aren't really strong institutions of any sort in South Sudan that will enable South Sudanese citizens to hold their government to account. So, really, it's this small elite in Juba that's pretty much unanswerable and has made itself very rich through the oil receipts. And really, frankly, as we're seeing right now, doesn't really care what what their people are going through right now.
Right. So they have plans for elections in 2015, but by then, who knows where they'll be? Were those elections put forth, the 2015 plan, was that put forth since South Sudan gained its independence or became a country, or was that a plan beforehand? How did that work?
Yeah, it was a date that was proposed as South Sudan became independent, although there were a number of important steps that have to be completed before South Sudan goes to an election, the most important of them being South Sudan still doesn't have a proper constitution. It only has an interim document. So the plan, at least, was that shortly after independence, a constitutional committee would get together and discuss this document, this foundational document for South Sudan that would help citizens have a stake in the way their country is governed. But as with many things in South Sudan, that whole plan has stalled. Progress has been lagging far, far behind because of this sort of perpetual crisis mode that has been driving the politicians in Juba. I think it's quite unlikely that elections will take place on schedule in 2015. And in fact, you know, if they're not prepared for properly, they could actually be a trigger for more violence unless they're carefully managed.
Bulawang, when you've gone back to your village, back to South Sudan, to work on the clinic, what did you get from the people who lived there? What were their sense about how things were going?
Yeah, the feeling of people was that if the country have independence, then we will be able to start over. We can try to do any jump start we can to grow the crop, to support ourselves. And if we have clinic in the area, like what we provide.
So they were optimistic.
Yeah, they feel like there will be change, even though it is coming slowly. Then they hope that their children would go to school, and then all the other basic need would be achieved.
But now everybody's gone from the village.
Everybody's gone from the village.
You don't have any idea what the clinic, how the clinic is.
Yeah, the clinic, like we spoke to somebody yesterday and he said that clinic is okay. They okay. have staff there, except that there's nobody there to be treated.
Okay.
Because all the children went out of
away.
The area to go for cover, and everybody who can manage to run are the one that is staying around. And if there's anything going on, because they don't have anything to protect them, they don't have weapon and they don't have anything. And every time when there's attack coming to the area, what you do is just run. If anything caught you, then that's the end of everything.
You and I were talking during the break about your 5-year-old daughter, who's a year younger than you were when you fled back and became a part of that group that we now know as the Lost Boys of Sudan. And I was wondering what you think about when you now you have this child of your own, and what you make of what her experience is compared to what yours was, and how you raise a child after what you went through.
Looking at my daughter now, 5 years old, and that's exactly the same time when I left my parent. When I look at her, I don't see anything much that she could do by herself without me and without the mother. And that's what the time when I start to be by myself without anybody beside me. And I have to sing like adults. I have to manage to find a food.
When you were 5 years
yeah,
old?
Yeah, in order to survive. I was able to walk in the endless distance so that I could go to the safe place. I have to think for what can I get for myself or can I survive this one. I have to run from the lion so that I could be safe. But when I look at my daughter now, and it's really, I feel like she could not do all these things by herself. So I know I was abused, but I was happy that we have independent. And when I try to come up with idea of clinic, I feel like all the children of my age should not go through what I went through when I was that child. I need the child to have a medication that could help them grow well as a healthy kid and go to school and decide their future. But during my time, I have no choice. I just have to find anything that could make me survive. But with my village now, it will be the beginning again. Like people who grow their crop during this time,
those will be all lost.
They just lost those mm-hmm. crop now because they have been exposed to the bird to eat them, and they couldn't have anything for harvest in a few days. And the next future for them will be just hunger and hunger.
Richard Downey, we mentioned earlier, we're running out of time, but that of all the African countries that came to independence since 1950, South Sudan has had the least amount of preparation. Is there a page from another country's book that South Sudan could look to emulate? Is there anything like South Sudan out there that did manage to survive these kinds of struggles?
South Sudan, in some ways, is in a class of its own, given the sheer weight of the challenges that it faced upon independence. Perhaps the only other comparison I could make is to a similarly troubled country in Africa, and that's Congo, Democratic Republic of Congo, which also achieved independence in a big hurry in 1960 and almost immediately fell into conflict as well. And there's perhaps a warning a salutary warning there in DRC of which continues to struggle today, but perhaps it could look to some of its neighbours that have done slightly better, and Uganda, Kenya, Ethiopia are three of those countries that still face immense challenges, mm-hmm. but have done a decent job of building a nation among pretty difficult circumstances, including conflict.
Richard Downey, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Richard Downey of the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. And Bola Wang, thank you for joining us again.
Thank you so much.
Bola Wang, he is one of the former Lost Boys of Sudan, an OSU grad. If you want to know more about the clinic, go to our website at WOSU.org/AllSides, and we have all the links you need there. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.